You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. On Tuesday, Congress returned from its recess to complete the annual funding process. The deadline, the end of the month, or face a government shutdown. Senate committees approved their appropriations bills pretty smoothly, but negotiations in the House proving to be more difficult. Wisconsin Democratic Representative Mark Pocan was on the morning show on WPR yesterday and shared his thoughts.
You know, normally the appropriations process isn't this messed up. During the Trump presidency, we still had people on appropriations, the committee that I serve on that do the budget bills, were people who still were rational, I guess is the best way to say it, to get things done. So, you know, there's a saying that there's Democrats, Republicans, and appropriators. The problem is when Kevin McCarthy became Speaker, part of the deal he cut in order to become Speaker was he put some of the more extremist members onto the committee, and, you know, they just didn't do their job this time for the first time ever.
Our next guest is a congressional correspondent here with us for a look at the roadblocks to a funding bill and yet another shutdown standoff, potentially in the works. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about how this annual government funding process works? Are you worried about the risks of a government shutdown? And in the House, do you want Republicans to use this process to negotiate things like spending cuts, restrictions related to abortion, and more? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Lisa Mascaro is the chief congressional correspondent for the Associated Press. Lisa, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
We just heard there a Wisconsin Democrat diagnosing what could be the problem here. Representative Pocan making the case that it's what's going on within the Republican caucus in the House. It's a big part of the story, Lisa. What is going on there and how does it affect these spending bills?
Yeah, absolutely. The House is in a real tangle again. In fact, the chamber came to a standstill here this afternoon as there's just a lot of infighting over how they're going to try to keep the government funded. The core of the issue is the conservative flank, those hard right Republicans that really power the majority here in the House for Speaker McCarthy. They are refusing to give their votes to go along with the spending bills at the sort of level that they're being set at. They really disagreed with that big deal that Speaker McCarthy and President Joe Biden reached earlier this year. The two set the spending levels for the year. It was part of a big deal back in spring to avert a big crisis over the debt ceiling. And now that they need to start passing the bills to fund the government, the conservative Republicans are just saying, no way, this is not what we wanted then. We voted against it, and we're not going to let it happen now. And so Speaker McCarthy is really trying to float other ideas for how to get maybe some of the bills through the House. He's looking at trying to pass a big defense bill, maybe a homeland security bill. But even this afternoon, a test vote that was coming up on the big defense bill to fund the Pentagon and related defense needs here in the country, the chamber just came to a complete standstill because he doesn't have the votes. And of course, Democrats are not interested in voting for the bills that McCarthy is putting on the floor because they have a lot of policies in them that the Democrats oppose. You know, Republicans want to do away with just a lot of different policies that are important to the Democrats. In the Pentagon, for example, the Republicans are trying to strip out a lot of the diversity and inclusion initiatives that the Pentagon has tried to put in place. Republicans call these the woke policies that they're trying to get rid of. And, you know, so that just makes it hard for Democrats to come on board. So these are the challenges that Speaker McCarthy faces. And there's not really a way out at this point. There's just maybe 10 days when the House is in session before September 30th. And that's when government funding runs out and when we would risk a federal shutdown But, you know, starting October 1st, if the Congress can't get these bills approved and get them up to President Biden's desk for signatures.
Let's give a listen to one of the members of the Further Right Freedom Caucus, about 45 members of the House. Here's Freedom Caucus Chair, U.S. Representative from Pennsylvania, Scott Perry.
We're here to put our foot down and say to this place right here, it stops now. The power of the purse is in the legislature. And the way you stop all this craziness of the Biden administration, the tyranny of the Biden administration, is to stop giving them money.
So that number I said, about 45 seats in the House with that narrow Republican majority you mentioned, makes it hard to pass things potentially. And there's been some talk from other members of that caucus that, like, hey, if we don't get what we want from Speaker McCarthy from our original deal with him, maybe he doesn't get to be Speaker anymore. How heated are things within the Republican caucus?
Well, that's exactly right. This threat of an ouster has hung over McCarthy since he won the gavel back in January. Folks might remember that was just a very contested vote. It took him 15 rounds day after day on the House floor to win the support from his own Republican majority to lead and to be the Speaker. When he finally won, he had reached an agreement with a lot of the holdouts, many of these same conservatives. And now they are holding him to those deals, and they're saying that he's not keeping up his end of the bargain. He faces this threat of ouster. It's not an idle threat. It is available to the conservatives. They have an ability through the House rules to file what's called a motion to vacate the chair. And, you know, they would need a majority of the House to vote for that. Now, they might not have a majority on the Republican side to oust Speaker McCarthy, but certainly Democrats might be interested in joining them on that. So it's a real risk. It's the tangle that Speaker McCarthy started his tenure with, and it's one that is hangs over him now through every step of his way here on Capitol Hill.
Talking to Lisa Mascaro, Chief Congressional Correspondent for the Associated Press, about funding negotiations going on right now in Congress, some roadblocks as we're hearing in the House. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see come out of this? Do you worry about the risk of at least partial government shutdown if deals aren't reached? Should Republicans on the right and the Freedom Caucus hold firm, block funding bills unless their demands are met? What do you want to see from Speaker McCarthy? Should he continue to be Speaker McCarthy? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Lisa, let's drop in on the Senate for a minute. I mean, it seems like, you know, it's not all love and harmony there, but it seems like the appropriations process is smoother on that side of the Capitol.
Well, yes, and this is fascinating. For the first time in a number of years, the Senate, sort of looking across the across the halls to the other side of the building, sees what's going on in the House. And this summer, they just started working together in a bipartisan way to pass the spending bills out of the different committees. There's 12 bills to fund the government. We don't often hear about those individual bills anymore because usually they can't. Neither chamber can get them out of their committees. Usually what we hear about are these big, you know, we call them omnibus packages that are a big wrap-up of all the bills. But the Senate, for the first time in years, did its work and passed each of these bills out of the committee, and now they're bringing them to the floor. They're kind of grouping them together in what we call a minibus, maybe three bills at a time grouped together. And it looks like they're going to start passing those in the Senate in a bipartisan way to get them over to the House and kind of pressure the House, you know, and say, look, we've reached agreement. We are working toward this agreement that the president and Speaker McCarthy, you know, had made last year. Some changes, some increases and shifts here and there. But for the most part, they're trying to work together to get that done and apply some pressure on the House. But as you heard from that comment from the chairman of the Freedom Caucus, Scott Perry, the conservatives in the House are in no mood to negotiate. And in fact, they want to work the other way and jam the Senate. You know, incidentally, We had news today with Senator Mitt Romney announcing that he would not be seeking re-election. And that shows you a bit of the frustration here in Congress that, you know, some of these longtime leaders, people that have really made a name for themselves in this country, trying to, you know, be moderate or somewhat, you know, more moderate and trying to operate, you know, experience the frustration and the concerns about the way these things are running here.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Dave is with us in Toma. Hi, Dave.
Yeah, hi. I think that they're just confirming that nowadays they're more interested in the welfare of their own jobs and the party than they are of the constituents.
And Dave, are you talking about Congress in general, or one party or the other, or the whole mess?
The whole mess nowadays.
Dave, thanks a lot for the call. I think Dave's not alone. Lisa, traditionally, Congress as a whole has very low approval ratings for the public. Is there concern from members of the House about what this looks like to the public at large? Or, as our caller suggests, are they more worried about the people who are going to give them money and vote for them in their local district?
You know, it's a fascinating question, right? And I think we see, you know, all different takes on that. I think one thing, you know, for certain is that, you know, the country is facing a lot of, you know, a lot of issues, a lot of concerns. I mean, there's a big war overseas. There are new developments in technology. There are needs across this country. Anyone who's driven across the states see, you know, we are in a changing environment, a changing era in this country, and there's a lot of attention, and sometimes Congress does seem to be stuck in some of these constant battles over, you know, these kind of issues that maybe don't reach the broad scope of all the concerns out there that Americans might have, you know, trying to have jobs and be able to get their kids to school and ensure that the country is safe and that technology is safe and that there is, you know, good infrastructure and all those sort of basic needs that folks have, you know, and you know, yet Congress often is sort of fighting what might seem like battles that don't always seem to directly address what's going on with folks back home.
We're talking to Lisa Mascaro, Chief Congressional Correspondent for the Associated Press, about funding negotiations in Congress and the possibility of a government shutdown. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you agree with Republicans on the Freedom Caucus looking for some spending cuts, policy changes before they sign on to appropriation bills? Is it worth the possibility of a shutdown? If so, what do you want to see from your representatives from Wisconsin over the next few weeks? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation with Lisa Mascaro, Chief Congressional Correspondent for the Associated Press, looking at this year's funding negotiations in Congress, the possibility of some form of government shutdown by the end of the month. You can join in with your thoughts. Questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Katie is with us in Marshfield. Katie, hi.
Hi. Hey, I have a comment about what these guys are doing in Washington and even in Madison. And my comment is this. Their jobs apparently don't seem to be very well defined, because I don't see that they're doing anything for the people who have voted for them. What about redefining what their duties are, for one thing? And then what about a national movement that says, do your job? Because they're not doing their job. That's not what we elected them for. And, I mean, how many of us would get to conduct ourselves in employment in the manner that they are?
Katie, so thanks. I gotcha. Thanks a lot for the call. Lisa, when I look at congressional elections each year, it seems like there's a majority of safe seats, some safe Republican and safe Democrat. There's fairly few members of Congress who have to look over their shoulder at the possibility that voters might toss them out.
This is true. The districts have just become so solidly sort of partisan in recent years, the past decade or two. You really see the firming up of sort of more Democratic leaning districts on the left, more Republican leaning districts on the right. I think we have about 15, 18 Republicans, for example, that are in districts that President Biden won, and just a handful of Democrats that represent districts that former President Trump won. So it really shows you how safe these seats are for so many people. For many of them, they're more concerned about a primary challenge, somebody more liberal or more conservative coming after them. And you really see that particularly on the right flank, where they do have more of these vocal and organized and energized conservatives on the farther right coming after the more moderate Republicans. And that is what's at stake for them as they try to make their decisions, knowing that they could be primaried at any time. And, you know, it is an interesting crossroads we're at. You know, Congress, you know, it's the first article there, you know, it's the first branch of government in many ways. It's the branch that is closest to the people. Needs to be representative of the people. That's the way our government was designed. And especially as we see the presidency becoming, you know, tumultuous at times with the different reach of executive power, both in former Trump's administration and the, you know, the efforts now in Biden's administration to sort of take charge where Congress has failed, you know, that gets into some really difficult terrain because we are supposed to have a Congress that represents the people, passes legislation, and tries to move away from a sort of strong, you know, executive that can take charge in certain areas, you know, away from Congress, particularly in the spending, you know, in the power of the purse. And so it is important for people to sort of be aware of what Congress does and be informed about their member. Often you hear people say they like their member of Congress, the person who represents them. You know, they just don't like the others. And, you know, that is also a sort of difficult issue because these guys all have to try to get along. You know, it's a big country and there's a lot of different regions, a lot of different needs, and a lot of different cultures within this country as they try to come together and figure stuff out that's best for the nation, you know, often with some difficulty to be sure.
Thanks a lot for the call, Katie. Peter is with us now in southeastern Wisconsin. Peter, hi.
Hello, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Well, you asked if we're afraid of the government shutting down. I'm not afraid at all. From what I understand, they're going to continue giving Social Security and Medicare benefits. And, you know, I think there's only 5%, from what I understand, that would actually get shut down. And, you know, when Obama was president and this happened, he made it as painful as possible and shut down the national parks. Biden does not have to do that. And inflation is so high because we keep spending money from the government. So I think we really got to cut back. And if they have to shut down for a while before somebody changes things, I'm fine with that.
Peter, thanks for the call. And Peter, I think sharing the sentiment of some of the Republicans in Congress who are open to the idea of a shutdown. What Peter said, Lisa, is true. It's a non-essential functions, however that ends up being defined, is what would end in the case of the shutdown, right?
Well, yes and no. I mean, there are ways that they can try to stem the losses of the shutdown, try to eliminate certain aspects of government from being shut down. But that also takes some agreement from Congress, you know, to do it that way. And, you know, as we've seen, it's very difficult for them to agree on so many of these things. I was talking with Senator Lisa Murkowski late last week for a story that we did over the weekend. And she said, look, you know, I'll talk to you about a shutdown. She talked about federal permits that need to be provided to certain fishermen in Alaska who are starting their fishing season. And she said during the last shutdown, you know, those permits couldn't be obtained. And it really
became difficult. So I think it depends. It depends on certain government agencies, and it depends. You know, we talk about trying to protect Social Security checks. Yes and no. At some point, you know, if the workers are told, you know, that they aren't to come to work because they won't get paid, then, you know, those checks wouldn't be issued. So it does depend, and it depends on how long Congress is willing to go to shut things down. You know, how many days. I think one of the longest shutdowns we had was something like 30 days. These things can be quick and they can get a resolution, or they can drag and perhaps cause more, you know, deeper pain than at the outset there.
Thanks a lot for that call. Just in our last few minutes, Lisa, what are you watching for next on these appropriations bills?
Oh, goodness. Well, I think for the moment, as we said at the outset, they've had to sort of shut down the floor activity today here in the House because the Republicans are unable to pass this big defense bill. They were trying to vote to launch that, and they couldn't get it launched today because of the opposition from conservatives. So they've got one more day at work here this week, tomorrow. And I think we want to see if they're able to break the logjam and get it rolling, or if Speaker McCarthy is sort of back at square one and doesn't really have a plan B for getting these bills off the floor. It seems right now they're in a real jam up. So we've got to see overnight if they can get to some resolution here and get things moving again tomorrow.
Lisa, thanks for bringing us up to date today.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
That's Lisa Mascaro, Chief Congressional Correspondent for the Associated Press. We talked to her today about federal funding negotiations going on now in Congress, whether the holdup could lead to some form of government shutdown. Deadline, end of the month. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, Google is big and it does a lot more than search engines. Is it a monopoly? Federal antitrust regulators are making the case that Google is too big. Find out why and join in with your thoughts. You can get started right now. Ideas@WPR.org. Do you want to see antitrust action against Google and other big technology companies? Then join the conversation tomorrow morning at 8 on the Ideas Network. Have you seen a new movie lately? Have you seen one in an actual movie theater? The movie experience has been changing over the years, not just because of COVID. The big screen at the theater is competing with the screens we have at home. But the Barbie and Oppenheimer movies got a lot of people back into the seats. Tomorrow on the show, we're going to talk about the theater experience and whether it's making a comeback. You can get things started right now. Do you go to see movies at theaters? How often? What do you like about the theater experience? And if you stopped going to theaters at some point, what led to that? Was it costs? Fancy home video equipment, the ability to pause the movie or make your own snacks? Let us know. You can email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Or you could post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Then join the conversation tomorrow here on the show. See you at the movies. Maybe. This is Central Time. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we take a look at this year's Farm Bill, a massive five-year spending package that includes agriculture, conservation policy, food assistance, and more. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about finding home within yourself.
How do you travel halfway around the world and still feel connected to home? For WPR's Karina Abrego-Cook of Green Bay, she listened to the sound of her own voice and the voice of someone she loves. She shares her story as part of the Home is Here project, which amplifies the voices of the growing number of Black, Asian, Native American, and Hispanic residents who call northeastern Wisconsin home.
Two things about me that you need to know for this story. I've always been loud and proud about my family's background and where I come from. Also, I'm an Anglophile, meaning I'm obsessed with British culture. It started with my love of Tears for Fears when I was 3, and then the Beatles in my teen years. Growing up, I was always forthcoming about my heritage. My family moved from Kenosha to Green Bay in 1987, and there weren't many people who looked anything like me in Northeast Wisconsin. So people often flat out asked me, "What are you?" I'm half Mexican, a quarter Japanese, an eighth Irish, and an eighth Norwegian. I joke that I'm diverse within myself, or I'd make a new term calling myself Hispasian, or triracial. I remember one time when I was 12, I was talking about our family background, and my dad said, "Yeah, but if you travel outside the country, you aren't gonna say that. You're gonna tell them you're American." That stuck with me my entire life. I had to wait another 12 years to leave the country to see how an exchange with someone from outside the country might go. My friend Sean asked me if I wanted to join him in London for his spring break. It was the trip of a lifetime. While there, we dined with a group of Romanian college students. My family background eventually came up in conversation, and their jaws dropped. They had never met someone with such a diverse background. In a way, it was a new experience for me too, because as Americans, we're used to people having ancestors from more than one country. My trip to London not only got me thinking about my triracial identity, but also my Wisconsin accent. You know the accent with its long vowels. Now, something strange happened in my short time in London. As the week progressed, my friend and I noticed my accent changing. One morning at a coffee shop, I ordered an Americano and I didn't recognize the voice that came out of my mouth. I didn't sound like my Wisconsin self. In fact, I sounded a little British. I was in London for less than a week and I was taking on bits of their accent. I was not totally surprised though. I've always been able to imitate or mimic others easily, though this time it was subconscious mimicking. Was it because I wanted to be British? Not for the food, but you know, the music and the culture, of course. Later that week, we went to the loudest Irish pub on St. Patrick's Day, and I struck up a conversation with a guy from Australia. I'm not sure how he could hear it, but he said I sounded like I was from Canada. And I laughed and I told him that I was from not far from there. So my Wisconsin accent wasn't completely gone. The next day was the moment I was really looking forward to during the whole trip. It was the visit to Abbey Road Studios. After doing all the touristy Beatle things and posing for photos, I couldn't wait to tell my dad about my adventure. After all, he bought me my first Beatles CD, Rubber Soul. Incidentally, it was the first Beatles album he had. I found one of those iconic red British phone booths to call my musician dad, who always fostered my love of music. After he answered, I told him how I walked across Abbey Road barefoot like Paul McCartney and peeped through the studio's iron gates. And it was at that moment, my friend said, that my Northeast Wisconsin accent came back completely. It's because I was talking to Dad in Green Bay. Wherever my dad is, that's home. My name is Karina. I'm half Mexican, a quarter Japanese, an eighth Irish, and an eighth Norwegian. I call Green Bay home, and you can hear it in my Wisconsin-accented voice.
Karina Abrego-Cook is an outreach specialist with Wisconsin Public Radio. And her story is part of the Home is Here project from the New News Lab, a local news collaboration in northeastern Wisconsin made up of six media organizations, including WPR and the Green Bay Press-Gazette. More information can be found at wisconsinlife.org. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, Congress is in the midst of ongoing negotiations over the Farm Bill, a multi-billion dollar five-year spending plan affecting farmers, rural communities, food assistance programs, conservation, and more. It's not clear whether lawmakers will meet the deadline just a few weeks away on September 30th. We're talking about the long journey to a new five-year omnibus spending plan that is the Farm Bill, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see changes to nutrition assistance programs? Are you a farmer yourself? What do you want to see in this year's Farm Bill that is the same or maybe different compared to the last bill back from 2018? Join in with your hopes, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Meredith Lee Hill is a food and agriculture reporter for Politico. Meredith, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
I give a tiny taste of the scope of the Farm Bill. It's big. Can you spell out some of what is part of this every five-year-ish Farm Bill?
Right. It's very large. I mean, the Farm Bill is really the cornerstone of the food and agriculture sectors in the U.S., and it's one of really the few bipartisan reauthorization bills left in Congress. And as you mentioned, it normally comes up every 5 years. As you mentioned, it provides funding for everything from, you know, rural job development programs, food assistance programs for more than 40 million low-income Americans, as well as conservation programs, crop insurance, and other support programs for farmers. So this year, for the first time, the bill is expected to top $1 trillion in spending over the next 10 years. So it is a massive bill, and it's a very big lift in Congress.
And the biggest items in this, I look at charts, I see the food assistance. When it comes to dollar amounts, that is a really big part of this. How important is that?
Right. It's a large part of the Farm Bill. Actually, 80% of the Farm Bill is made up from nutrition programs, and the largest of that being the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, which helps feed more than 41 million low-income Americans. And that program is really at the center of a big, larger fight on Capitol Hill right now. We saw it come up earlier this year in the debt ceiling negotiations between Democrats and President Joe Biden and House Republicans. House Republicans were able to pare back some of the eligibility around that program. And so that is one of the major fights coming up in the Farm Bill, is that, again, Republicans are looking to pare back spending on the program, especially after increases for food assistance during the pandemic that we saw over the past few years. Democrats are very opposed to that. They want to boost spending on nutrition in order to stave off some of the food insecurity that we saw grow during the pandemic.
And then let's turn to the farming side. Now, farmers get some benefit from those food aid programs because presumably people are using food aid to buy food grown by farmers. But when it comes to direct programs that directly affect farmers, what are some of the key items in the Farm Bill?
Right. Yes, obviously, farmers do get indirect benefits from the food aid programs, but other programs, especially some of the commodity support programs, some things like crop insurance, those are really risk management tools that farmers rely on when there's bad weather or other natural disasters that hit at any time for farmers. So there's really important farm programs in the Farm Bill as well that Republicans especially, but also Democrats in rural districts are very fierce supporters of and are looking to protect this year.
Now, in Congress right now, there's a defense appropriation bill, a lot of other spending bills. We just had this impeachment inquiry drop. Is there just so much going on in Congress that the Farm Bill could end up being on a back burner?
Right. I mean, we're seeing really the delays pile up this year. Right now, as you mentioned, there's a major government funding fight going on where lawmakers are racing essentially to stave off a federal shutdown on October 1st. So really all the oxygen on Capitol Hill is around the appropriations process, around this government spending fight. And so the Farm Bill has gradually gotten delayed more and more as the year has gone on. And it is unlikely at this point that there is a sliver of time, even before the end of the year, where either the House and or the Senate version of the Farm Bill might make it to the floor for a full floor vote. The committees are still working on the bills. They're hammering out conversations and talks around some of these big contentious issues. We mentioned the fight over nutrition funding, over some of the commodity support programs. There's big questions about a pot of nearly $20 billion in climate-related agriculture funds from Democrats' Inflation Reduction Act that goes for Farm Bill conservation programs. Republicans would like to move some of that money around to fill some spending gaps. Democrats are very opposed to that. So that's another big issue that they're working through as we face a September 30th deadline where some of the beginning programs of the Farm Bill expire. But really, the big cliff for the Farm Bill is the end of the year. And so lawmakers are going to have to decide in the next few weeks whether to work on a larger extension if they're unable to get anything done before the end of the year.
Yeah, if nothing gets done by the end of the year, and if somehow there's no extension, what happens to all these programs we're talking about? I assume they don't shut down. I don't know, maybe they do.
Right. I mean, there are there's a variety of things that happen. And one of the odd things about the Farm Bill is that if it's not reauthorized, a lot of the programs, especially around commodities, you know, row crops, things like corn, soy, those were actually revert to Depression era, like 1930s and 1940s laws. And that essentially impacts how much the federal government is buying of certain commodities and also the essentially the equation around some of the support that farmers get. And so really, it just throws all of those things into chaos a little bit. So in order to stave off that, some of those, either the funding or the reauthorization problems, lawmakers are really committed to, if they are unable to get a full Farm Bill reauthorization done before the end of the year, they will likely, if there's another continuing resolution in Congress over spending, maybe in November, that's when they're going to decide if there's maybe a 1 year or a 2 year extension of the current Farm Bill.
Talking to Meredith Lee Hill, is a food and agriculture reporter for Politico, talking about the upcoming deadline for the multi-billion dollar 5 year Farm Bill. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Does the Farm Bill affect you directly, or do you want to know if it affects you if you use or have used food assistance programs like SNAP or work with people who do? If you are a farmer yourself, if you rely on things like a federal crop insurance or subsidies for certain types of commodity crops, join in with your thoughts, your experiences, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Politico food and agriculture reporter Meredith Lee Hill, looking at the federal Farm Bill, which Congress needs to sign by September 30th. Sounds like they probably won't. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about what the Farm Bill does? What is in it? Do you want to see changes to food assistance? One of the points of contention. How about agriculture-related carbon neutral efforts, climate change efforts? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Ross is with us in Middleton. Ross, hi.
Hi. The question I'm wondering about is if they know what kind of incentives assistance for smaller farmers, maybe in the organic farming area, and or like what might be thought of as sustainable farming.
Ross, thanks a lot for the call. As I understand it, Meredith, that has been in past farm bills. What might that include?
Right. Some of the work that Democrats took on in their Inflation Reduction Act is that they really wanted to push more sustainable and climate-focused efforts into U.S. agriculture. And so some of the, there's a pot of nearly $20 billion in funding that will likely be brought into the Farm Bill that is for conservation programs that farmers use in order to capture carbon and other sustainable efforts. So that is one main piece of that. I will say on your other point of your question for smaller farmers, I think that is a big emphasis this year for the Biden administration in particular. We've seen in past farm bills and a bigger argument from some of the progressive Democrats is that there are too many subsidies in the Farm Bill for larger farms, and really small farms need a lot of attention, especially in the upper Midwest. And so some of the programs that some Republicans and Democrats are looking at would boost assistance and especially for technical support and other efforts to help smaller farmers get USDA loans and other access to aid. That is something that they're looking to beef up in this Farm Bill.
Thanks a lot for the call, Ross, at 800-642-1234. Can you talk about some of the politics here, Meredith? I mean, often there are Democrat and Republican issues. This is also a case where, in reading your reporting, there are agricultural state and everybody else issues. How does that all play into this?
Mm-hmm. Of the politics on the Hill you're talking about?
Exactly, yeah, within Congress.
Right. It is an interesting, there's been an interesting change, especially in the makeup of the agriculture committees over the past few decades. Obviously, Democrats have lost their stronger foothold in rural districts. And so a lot of the rural districts, a majority now are represented by Republicans. And there are a few Democrats still in rural districts, but that really changes the priorities and the makeup of some of these efforts. And so Republicans, for the most part, are really interested in protecting production agriculture across the country and farm efforts there. And Democrats have, especially those in rural districts, are really interested in protecting things like crop insurance and all the commodity programs for farmers. But a large contingency of Democrats are in districts that no longer touch any farms. And so one of their bigger priorities is boosting food aid under the nutrition programs to make sure people in rural areas, but also in urban areas, get food assistance.
Now, the Senate will include some agricultural state senators, Democrats and Republicans, Wisconsin included. Are things moving any more smoothly or advancing more when it comes to the farm bill on the Senate side of things, or as opposed to the House, or is there just not a lot of action anywhere?
There's an awful lot of talk. The action is all. There's also some pretty big problems on the Senate side as well. The big issue there, as I mentioned before, is really Senate Agriculture Committee Chairwoman Debbie Stabenow, who I just talked to yesterday about this, is really trying to work through a lot of the funding challenges with limited new funds this year. And she's working very hard to keep some of these climate funds for agriculture programs where they are. But that also leads to a lot of other hard decisions about other farm programs and balancing that with all the nutrition programs that she also wants to keep whole. And so that's something that she is working through with the top Republican on the Senate Agriculture Committee, John Bozeman of Arkansas. He's very interested in boosting commodity reference prices for farmers along with crop insurance. And so that is something that they're working through, but it has been quite a slog, and they are expecting not to have text out of their committee, like a full farm bill draft, likely until maybe November or later.
Talking to Meredith Lee Hill, food and agriculture reporter for Politico, looking at progress or lack of progress on the federal five-year farm bill and how it affects people around the country, food programs, farmers, and a lot more. Are there people, Meredith, trying to lead an effort to sit down and get this thing rolling maybe by the end of the year? Is there any prospect that it seems like people will kick this into gear?
They are definitely talking as much as they can. Lawmakers, the top Republican and Democrat on both the House and Senate Agriculture Committee are in pretty frequent contact, talking through kind of the massive bill and all of the priorities that they have to get through. They have made some progress on looking at where they can plus up funds. Senator Stabenow and Bozeman recently asked Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack to use some internal USDA funds to boost trade programs for U.S. agriculture exports abroad. And they think that might free up some money in the farm bill for, you know, some of the other efforts that they're trying to fund. So they are working through things. They're talking, and I think we'll see once we get through the government funding effort. We have to remember that the top Democrat on the Senate Agriculture Committee, Debbie Stabenow, is a member of Democratic leadership. So she's very mired in the government funding fight right now herself. And so I think once we get through October 1st, there'll be a chance for them to sit down with some more, hopefully, meat on the bones in these talks.
Meredith, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
Meredith Lee Hill is a food and agriculture reporter for Politico. She talked to us about the ongoing efforts to pass a farm bill by the end of the year. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, so-called artificial intelligence programs like ChatGPT could have a big impact on schools. An English teacher joins the show to make the case that we need to start rethinking the way we teach language and literature in the AI era. And Barbie and Oppenheimer got people back into movie theaters over the summer. Was that a blip or the start of something new? Check out the future of movies in actual theaters and share your experiences. You can start right now on the Ideas Network Facebook page. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, tweens and teens live a big part of their lives online, and it can be tough to navigate the social media landscape. The author of the new book, Growing Up in Public, shares advice for parents and for kids. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.